Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm attorney Barry Vogel. What happens when the modern scientific world and the ancient traditions of Tibetan monastics meet? Geshe Labsang Tenzin Negi, our guest in this edition of Radio Curious, has spent many years in spiritual meditation training. He was born in a remote village in the Himalayas and chosen at age 14 to study at the Institute of Buddhist Dialectics, the private school of His Holiness the Dalai Lama in Dharamsala. Geshe Negi, now a senior lecturer in the Department of Religion and the director of the Emory-Tibet Partnership based at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, also serves as the co-director of the Emory-Tibet Science Initiative with the aim of developing and implementing a science curriculum for Tibetan monastics. His career has focused on the potential of the mind to affect well-being on physical, emotional, and mental levels. During our visit, we discuss what it was like for him to move to monastic life at an early age and how meditation can be beneficial to all of us, both spiritually and physically. I spoke with Geshe Labsang Tenzin Negi by phone from Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, on July 31st, 2009, and began our conversation by asking him to tell us about his childhood. From your birthplace to where you are now as a senior lecturer at Emory University and a director of the Emory-Tibet Partnership, if you could share with us what happened in your life from your early childhood to where you are now in such a different culture than the one into which you were born.
I was born in the Himalayas, just way up in the Himalayas. It's called Kinor or Kunu in Tibetan, which is right at the Indo-Tibetan border, but it is on the Indian side of the border. But an area that culturally and ethnically is Tibetan. And I spent my first 10 years or so there. From 10 to 14, I went to a school a little bit inside India. When I was 14, I went to Dharamsala, where His Holiness the Dalai Lama lives. And I became a monk at age 14 in the monasteries there.
You were selected to be a monk, is that right?
Yes.
How does that selection process work?
Well, this was a kind of specific situation because, as I mentioned, that the area that I come from is culturally and ethnically Tibetan Buddhist area. But ever since the invasion by the Chinese communists, it impacted on the Buddhist culture and religion of those Himalayan regions as well. In 1974, when one of the high lamas who was giving an extended teaching in my hometown, was asked by His Holiness the Dalai Lama about the situation of Buddhism in that particular area. He reported to His Holiness that there were many older monks and nuns, but among the younger generation, you know, there were not many. So His Holiness had asked this lama, he's known as Kangyur Rinpoche in that area, to bring three kids to be trained in Buddhist philosophy, and I was one of them.
Are you still in contact with the other two?
Yes. In June, I saw both of them in India. I was in India, in Dharamsala, so you know, I was able to see them briefly.
I could ask your age.
I am 49.
So tell us, perhaps if you can summarize it, I'm sure many years of training would take a long time to describe, but what was it that you learned as a 10-year-old child, as you matured into a man, that you still carry with you and practice?
Well, I think that I feel that I was fortunate to be brought up by parents who were very deeply devoted to the Dharma, meaning that the practice of the Buddhist teachings. And at a very early age, I learned just by, you know, through stories and example, the value of love and compassion, the respect for others. And I think that those qualities, I feel that it's still something that I very much cherish and find it very meaningful.
Those qualities form a part of your work at Emory University.
Well, actually, for many years in Dharamsala, I attended a monastic school called the Institute of Buddhist Dialectics. I studied there for 10, 11 years and then moved to Drepung Losling Monastery, which is a monastic university now located in South India, and completed my monastic training there and received my Geshe degree, which is the degree that you can earn through completing the Tibetan monastic education. That includes philosophy, psychology, logic, and so forth. I studied all those, but I think that when I came here in Atlanta, in the USA, and started teaching at Emory University, eventually, when I learned through my colleagues that meditation are something that are being looked into through the scientific community, that there are various people conducting research in various forms of meditation. At Emory University, my colleague, Dr. Charles Loizan, he and I, when we started planning for some form of study, we thought that the compassion meditation would be the relevant one to start to see how it benefits as individuals from the perspective of health, you know, mental and physical health.
When you say compassion meditation, does that indicate that there are other forms of meditation?
Meditation is a topic, it's very broad. It includes many things. Meditation simply is a training, basically. It's a meditation, Sanskrit word bhavana, which is meant to cultivate or to familiarize. So it's a training, that's a process of enhancing or deepening, you know, your experience of certain qualities. So from that perspective, you could say that meditation can be about compassion, enhancing and deepening your compassion for yourself and for others. But a very popular form of meditation that has been studied among scientific communities here in the West is what is known as mindfulness meditation. Now, that's a very basic but very universal form of meditation. But then the meditation can be something that involves visualization of some very advanced meditations, involve a very active kind of form of visualization in which you relate to yourself through imaginative depth, as well as the environment and your activities and resources around, in a completely from a different perspective, from a more, you know, what you may call a transcendental perspective, seeing yourself as a deity, your place as a mandala, you know, your activities as the beneficial activities to benefit others, and all the resources as the manifestation of the transcendent wisdom.
What I would like to ask you, Geshe Labsang Tenzin Negi, is about the Emory Tibet Science Initiative, which you're the co-director. But before we get there, I'd like to say that in this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Geshe Labsang Tenzin Negi, who is the director of the Emory Tibet Partnership and the co-director of the Emory Tibet Science Initiative and the Emory Collaborative for Contemplative Studies. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Well, Geshe Labsang, the science initiative, bringing concepts of science to your colleagues in the monastic life in Tibet. Can you tell us about the origin of that project as a place to begin?
Yes, the Emory Tibet Science Initiative is a program to develop a comprehensive and sustainable science curriculum for Tibetan monks and nuns. And this is really a project to assist the Dalai Lama in his vision or the effort to make modern science one of the core curricula at Tibetan monastic institutions. He believes very strongly that at this point, we are at a point where we can really benefit the best of the two very sophisticated traditions, that is the modern science that has extensive knowledge and sophisticated understanding about the physical world and how it impacts our bodies, ourselves, and the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, on the other hand, has a very long history of very closely studying, looking into the inner world of mind and emotion, and therefore it has tremendous knowledge about how to work with inner states of the mind. So he believes, his Holiness the Dalai Lama believes that the convergence of these two traditions, not as a Buddhism, not necessarily as a religion, but more as a science of inner mind, if you will, inner science of the mind, and the modern science as the science of the physical world, if you will. These two together, I think, can really give new perspective, new understanding about the human condition, and therefore to serve the humanity in many of its needs, whether it comes to health, physically or emotional health, harmony, and at all different levels of our human condition. I think that's it.
In the course of your work, have you discovered new insights into these traditions and into the understanding of the mind and the body connection?
I would not claim that I have developed very extraordinary understanding, but I have been involved with the field of, you know, mind-body connection. Certainly that my own study of modern science, particularly from the evolutionary and the neuro, you know, scientific perspective, has certainly given me different insights into kind of understanding the way that our emotions.
Could you share with us some of those insights?
Certainly. For example, in the Buddhist tradition, we believe that emotions, let's say, you know, positive emotions like compassion or the negative emotions like anger or hostility, they have a direct impact on our life, positively and negatively. And our own study here, for example, this compassion meditation that we have been conducting at Emory for the last 3-4 years, it in some ways kind of demonstrates how this positive emotion like compassion, when it is practiced or incorporated in one's life, how actually it makes a difference even at the level of immune system, that there is some cell called the IL-6 related to stress and inflammation. And you know, our studies, among other things, focused on that particular immune cell to see after 6 weeks of meditation training whether those students who were in the meditation group had any different level of interleukin-6, IL-6, than the control group. The implications here is that the IL-6 level is reduced in those than under kind of a stressful situation. That would mean that they would be better, you know, off kind of dealing with a more stressful situation, so therefore be able to hopefully avoid perhaps severe depression and other forms of illnesses.
In determining the reduction of stress or the increase in the ability of the immune system, has the Emory Tibet Science Initiative employed Western scientific tests to evaluate on an empirical basis the reduction of stress or the increase in the immune system's ability to protect a person?
Yes, the study that we have conducted is standard scientific research based on the principles of Western scientific research. And so, yes, methodology used is standard Western scientific methodology. And our findings actually are published in the journal called Psychoneuroendocrinology in October 2008.
And the findings are essentially what you have just explained to us.
Yeah, findings basically that people who practice greater degree of compassion, in other words, those who spend more time in doing compassion meditation, they show lesser degree of stress when they are subjected to some stressful situation, and therefore that on the immune level, that a reduced level of IL-6, that is a particular immune cell that correlates with stress, but also that the cortisol, the stress hormones, other stress hormones, are also reduced in the high practice group of compassion meditation. But also, in a subjective kind of experience of mood, whether they feel more hostile, more angry about others, or less connected with others, those who practice more seem to have a greater degree of like this connectedness with others and a lesser degree of anger or hostility towards others.
For people who don't have immediate access to training in meditation, where could they pick up these skills?
Well, I think that nowadays in most of the major cities in the United States, I'm sure that there are various meditation groups. Some places you may have Buddhist centers, other places just other meditation centers. The best thing is to find a person who teaches meditation in your location, in your city or the area. And it's important to study with someone and to be able to participate in this meditation on a more regular basis, at least in the beginning.
Can you give us some ideas as to what a person would be taught to develop these skills? Perhaps something that might help our listeners develop an enthusiasm to do so?
Certainly. Just to really simplify, you can think of just five steps. One would need to develop what is called the attentional stability, that is to develop a greater degree of being in the present. For any basic form of meditation or the yoga exercises will incorporate that training to be in the moment, in the present. And secondly, what is important is to be more aware of one's own inner feelings, thoughts, hopes, expectations, worries, and so forth, so that you are not unaware of what is happening in your body, in your mind. Because if we remain ignorant about our emotional reactions, anxieties, worries, and so forth, it would be easy for us to keep reinforcing the same habitual patterns. So developing a mindfulness of our own thoughts, feelings, emotions, and so forth in such a way that we are not necessarily judging them, but by maintaining a certain degree of equanimity, that non-judgmental kind of awareness of one's own unfolding experiences of thoughts, feelings, emotions, and so forth. Those are kind of the basic meditation. Then eventually what is important is to, make the connection between which thought, feelings, and emotions lead to the disturbance of your mind or the life, and what kind of mental state promote the greater degree of peace or joy, happiness, and well-being. And that would be the way that you would be able to make a determination to promote those mental aspects that are healthy and to transform the work to reduce the mental activities that are unhealthy, like anger, jealousy, and so forth. Really, actual compassion, when it comes to compassion for others, has to incorporate two steps. Number one, equanimity, that to begin to relate to others, other people that we interact in our daily life, whether they are our friends or strangers or people even who give us difficulties. Instead of simply relating to those superficial kind of interactions we have with them as friends and so forth, trying to understand that each and every one of them is the same like you, wanting to be happy and to be free from any misfortunes or the dissatisfactions and so forth. On that level, we are all same. So that insight is important, and of course one needs to work on that, but that is the kind of the foundation for compassion for others. From there, then the second and crucial part is finding a way to develop a sense of endearment or cherishing for others. And that can be done by simply developing greater awareness of how we are interdependent, how we depend on every bit of comfort and joy and benefits in our life, so how we depend for those on countless other beings. And in that way, to really see that interdependent and the interconnected the nature of ourselves. So that will help develop a sense of gratitude and appreciation for others, and thereby a sense of closeness and affection, if you will. That helps you to have greater empathy for others. If you see others enjoying life, you will rejoice. If you see others struggling with the disease or the, you know, misfortunes and other struggles, difficulties, the empathy that with which you can feel the difficulties would help you experience compassion. That is the wish for them to be free from those misfortunes.
In terms of the scientific connection and the scientific initiative between Emory and Tibet, what has been the newness that has been brought to the monastics in Tibet when they're presented with mathematical instruction and the scientific method on the Western side?
The Tibetan monastic curriculum never had the modern science component to it. So therefore, that literally everything that is presented to them is new, whether it is about the evolutionary concept of life, that how the life was formed, that how it evolved. It's quite different or new to the Tibetan monks to see the life in that way. To also in the neuroscience part, you know, that the close relation of our mind and emotions with the brain, and you know, the subtler kind of the brain activities and the neurochemicals and so forth and so on. Even though it's not that the Tibetan tradition would not believe that, but through the modern technology, the scientific technology, the very kind of the close understanding of the workings of the brain and how they express, those activities express in different form of emotions and thoughts and so forth. I think that those are very fascinating and insights.
How is the modern science approach received by the monastics? Or maybe asked this way, are there difficulties in conceptualizing that modern science approach, modern being Western?
Well, I mean, certainly that, you know, it's a very different way of looking at reality, at the things, life, you know, the mind and so forth. The thing is that the Tibetan Buddhist tradition and His Holiness the Dalai Lama as the leader for Tibetan Buddhist tradition, you know, that have been very open to new ideas, new approaches, and therefore that these new ideas are received with a great openness, and in fact that they say a tremendous kind of degree of excitement and, you know, among the monastic community to study modern science, not necessarily everything, but the important issues that they also reflect from the Buddhist point of view, the very issues, if the happiness and the well-being is what we desire, how are we to pursue them? What are the methods for bringing about them? If the very suffix is something that we want to avoid, what are the methods for what contributes to such suffering or the, you know, the unwanted miseries and so forth, and how to go about overcoming those elements that promote suffering. So in that regard, I think that in many ways, the modern science and the Tibetan Buddhist tradition have many common places or the common goals in that area. The Tibetan monastics are very interested to see what light the modern science is able to shed.
You mentioned overcoming some of the impediments. Can you tell us about which impediments have been successfully overcome, or the learning that has identified itself to overcome those impediments?
It's quite early. I mean, we have, mind you, we have been just in 2 years right now. So I think that the impediments for our happiness and the well-being, I mean, that to be able to overcome through this interaction, I mean, it's at a very beginning phase. But what is being overcome is that, you know, like the misunderstanding, the lack of understanding about, you know, each other's tradition. It's certainly, I think, that the more the monastics learn about the modern science, and, you know, for that matter, our science faculty who learn about where the monks and the nuns are coming from, their own, you know, tradition and the philosophical kind of underpinnings and so forth. You know, it's an opportunity for both to really learn from each other. And there are certainly that both sides greater degree of excitement about this project.
Well, I found this to be a very fascinating conversation, and I would love to learn more. Geshe Lobsang Tenzin Negi, I want to thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And before we close, I'd like to ask you to tell us about an interesting idea or philosophy that's been important to you throughout your life, or one that you have learned recently.
Well, I think that, as a Buddhist, this idea of interconnectedness has been really a very important concept for me. But recently, back in June, when we were with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, all the monks and nuns who were studying Western science, and the Emory faculty, and the students, group of students who were studying Tibetan form of the mind-body connection. When we were with His Holiness, he made a comment about how this concept of interconnectedness or interdependence is so crucial, that when you look through the lens of that interconnectedness, that it changes your perspective about the world. And so that was really something very poignant moment for me to see how this concept of interdependence is so crucial for our own well-being and the way that we can treat ourselves and others, and therefore feel differently. That if we can see we are interdependent, we will have a different degree of respect for others.
And may I ask you to tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
Well, I've read several, but I think that in this context, I would say a book called The Universe in a Single Atom by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And it is a book on convergence of science and spirituality. I mean, this is a fascinating book, really wonderful book.
Well, Geshe Lobsang Tenzin Negi, again, I want to thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you so much.
Geshe Lobsang Tenzin Negi is a senior lecturer in the Department of Religion and director of the Emory-Tibet Partnership. He also serves as co-director of the Emory-Tibet Science Initiative at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. I spoke with him by phone from Emory University on July 31st, 2009. The book Geshe Lobsang Negi recommends is The Universe in an Atom by the Dalai Lama. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format. To get a copy, visit our website for further details. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. And the phone is 707-462-6541. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.